As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Than whole, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm Young H.O., raps great for dead. Back to take over the globe, now break bread.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Miami Nice. I am one half of your crazy undercover and potentially drunk, blackout drunk, that is, team of co-hosts for this podcast. I'm Blake Howard. Hello, my co-host, the amazing film critic. I mean, just toiling with week-on-week releases. Kathy Walsh, welcome back. We're just like, we're firing these out. It's so good that we're back together so many times on this.
Let's take it to the limit one more time.
That's it. We now have a guest. So we've been talking to some of our great film critic friends around the place who have been celebrating Miami Vice's 15th anniversary in a bunch of different publications online, and we're hoping you really enjoyed that. We've also now talking to a fellow podcaster and a bit of a man head, because we've kind of broadly touched upon, I guess, the incredible philosophy of Michael Mann films and specifically Miami Vice a few times. But the person that we're speaking to today is actually an expert for a change, it feels like, about that sort of thing, instead of this sort of pseudo understanding of what we are, what we've got. We've got an associate professor of philosophy from MIT and the host of his own podcast about philosophy and movies, Cows in the Field, which I was lucky enough to be a part of, talking another Michael Mann movie, Ali, one that I rarely get to talk about on podcasts. So thank you very much. It's Justin Koo. Justin, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thanks for having me. Big fan of the show and both of you, so I'm excited to be here.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say.
Thank you. That's so sweet.
So I'm interested in, like, what movies and what filmmakers excite or interest you, or like consistently pique your curiosity as someone who is, you know, an expert in the field.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to, we started doing this podcast to, like, just talk about movies. And then I was like, well, I guess I'm a philosopher, so we should, like, do philosophy. So then, you know, we would do things like in Minority Report, I would talk about, talk about free will, or we would talk, really, actually, Minority Report, on that note, actually, it's not as much about free will as it's about what's sometimes called middle knowledge, which is this knowledge that God has, allegedly God has, of what free creatures would have done in various non-real circumstances.
Yes.
This is a slightly different thing than I think it often is characterized as, is like foreknowledge and freedom. I would often do this. So we did Terminator 2 and we talked about, like, time travel and different models of the metaphysics of time and how time travel could be possible, how it's possible actually to change the future. Sorry, you could change the future, of course, but it's possible to change the past in various models of time, which seems, you know, can seem unintuitive in a way. And then, but we kind of, as we went on, we were like, yeah, we can talk about how these movies embody philosophical themes and, you know, can be used as insight into certain philosophical ideas, or we can just sort of engage philosophically with the movie. And so yes. A lot of what we've been doing recently is like, I think what we did with you with Ali is just like, we take a movie like Ali, which might not on the surface be a movie that is trying to do philosophy or anything like that, but just like engage with the text philosophically. So start to like think about like the nature of competition or the nature of like striving and struggle and what, you know, how that's depicted on the in the film and what that sort of tells us about ourselves, that we're attracted to watching this kind of thing, to watching people be overcome that kind of adversity. And so that's what the podcast has been more about recently. And you know, I think with Miami Vice, there's a lot of really interesting, you know, textual themes going on here that can be engaged with. It's, of course, this is not a movie about time travel, so we're not going to do time travel, but it's, you know, or the metaphysics of persons or something like that. But it still has a lot of, I think, like really deep themes that are the sort of things that bring me back to the movie, like make me want to come back and watch it again and again. So.
What are the themes?
Well, yeah. It's a great yeah.
I'm just like, I'm a dumbass, so I will be asking the dumb question.
I was literally gonna say, like, let's unpack some of the things.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's get into it.
Yeah, I just started like laughing at myself, being like, I feel like I'm a student. Like, I just want to listen and be like, tell me what are the themes.
Tell me.
Well, I want to know what you guys think too, because you guys are way more versed in this movie. I'm sure you've seen it more than I have. I mean, my actually initial experience with the movie was only a few years ago. Like, I wasn't on my radar, and I watched it on a lark. I think it was on Netflix a few years ago, and I was like, let's just put this on. I'd heard it was like people didn't like it, so I was like, okay, let's see. And at the end of the movie, my wife, who Blake, you've met, Laura, who hosts Cows in the Field with me, she turned to me and was like, that was like a weird joke. And she was about to say that, I guess. And then I was like, whoa, that was amazing. I was really like, I was really taken by that. And she had like the exact opposite reaction. She thought it was like, obviously, you know, she had all the usual critiques people have of the movie. It's confusing. It's melodramatic, blah, blah, blah. And I was trying to figure out why it resonated with me. And I think the initial thing that brought me into it was that it's incredibly relentless, especially the theatrical cut. I mean, I think the director's cut is a little slower in places, but the theatrical cut is just like nonstop. And it's almost just like nonstop, like musical montages almost. Like, it's just like, there's so much music, there's so much energy. And that like carried me through it. But then, you know, coming back to it, we have to rewatch Miami Vice. Like it was like a month later, and usually I don't do that. And so I forced my wife to rewatch it, and I think she grew on her a little bit. But then, you know, the themes made themselves more apparent to me. So here's what I took from it, at least initially. So here's some thoughts to put out to you guys. So you know, one is this theme of like loneliness, and there's a certain feeling that we all live in cities, so we all know that kind of particular urban feeling of like feeling alone but surrounded by people. It's a weird feeling, because it's not the same as being isolated. Like, when you're in the middle of nowhere, you're alone and it's kind of lonely. But like, when you're around a whole bunch of people but who are like in a way strangers, that's like there's a different feeling to that. But I think this takes it a step further, because with Sonny, he's surrounded by friends and in a way family, and yet he's deeply alone. He's also in a city with like endless adventure, and he's got all these opportunities to meet people. I mean, in the very first scene, hitting on a bartender.
I was just gonna say, it's a smorgasbord. It's a feast. It's like beautiful women.
Yep.
You know, like alcohol, music. You know, sights, sounds, fashion, interesting people.
But he's still trying to connect with someone, right? Yes. Like the pickup line. He's trying to learn something about her, you know? I mean.
Hey, darling. Two Bacardi mojitos and a gin and tonic.
Lemon or lime?
Lime.
Where you from?
Lisboa. That's in Portugal.
But you got your tan in Miami? What's your name?
Rita.
Rita. Sunny. See you later, Rita.
And seems genuinely interested in a way.
I think he really is. I mean, he gives her $100 tip also, which is like kind of like a, that's like a little bit of, at that point, actually, in the movie, you're kind of, you could be forgiven for thinking like this guy could just be a real skeez. You know? Like,
that's a Miami PD budget, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know. I'm just like, where else would he be? Like, he's like writing a receipt like, oh petty cash, like $300, whatever. It's just funny. I'm like, what else? Where else would he get $300 to tip? It's just funny.
I love to think that he doesn't even own, like, in the whole movie, you never see a place where he lives.
Right.
So I just imagine that he has so little connect, like this stupid, like little thought experiments you do with yourself. You're like, he doesn't have a house. He doesn't, I bet you he doesn't have a car. That's not a company car. I bet you he has, I don't even know if he's got an electricity bill. I have no idea where he sleeps. Like there's just no, he could probably sleep in his car in a car park or in the airplane hangar, you know, like,
yeah, he goes home with a different lady every night. Right. So he's like, he just couch surfs or whatever.
I can totally picture Sunny's apartment, which is like, has like a box for a coffee table, you know, a microwave and maybe like, it's like a bachelor apartment with like out without a real kitchen, you know what I mean? Like it's like he hasn't moved in. There's like basically like a mattress on the floor.
It's, you know, Rustin Cole's apartment from True Detective at Matthew McConaughey is like one of my favorite depictions of that, because he's like pile of books, mattress on the floor that's grubby, so you know the sheets that are white are gonna eventually look like teeth plaque, you know, they're gonna look disgusting, and just that tiny weird mirror that he stares with his eyeball in on the wall, like that's the kind of energy I feel that Crockett's house or apartment
same
would
energy.
Have say big mood, it's a big mood, and they're both prescribing to it
totally. Yeah, and I think like that idea that like, you know, he's alone and he's looking for someone, and Isabella's alone too, right? She's surrounded, she has this huge like network of people that are at her beck and call. She's like number two in the Montoya crime family or whatever. Like she's clearly like, you know, she's set aside. When they first meet her, you don't even, she's in the scene, but she's not in the shots, right? She's off to the side. You don't even see her until she pipes up to like sort of tell Euro what's what or whatever. And so I think you have these two characters who are like surrounded by people, but they're alone and they're like looking for each other. Of course, it's also like a tragedy. This film is like Shakespearean tragedy. I think it's basically just Romeo and Juliet. Like it's these people who have come, they're like looking for each other. They find each other and then they can't be together. And that's like horribly tragic. And like
I'm an undercover cop and you're the drug lord's wife.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so they're like, you know, and throughout that triggers this third theme that I really, really like, that really resonates with me, which is this like contemplative, reflective theme. So I feel like the movie, because the character is like, I've realized like, okay, we're in this situation, which is like, we can't be together or whatever, or Rico realizes that, you know, the actions that they've done have gotten Trudy injured, you know, potentially fatally injured. They reflect and they're like, did we make the right choices? Is this worth it? Should we have chosen this life at all? Like, why are we doing what we're doing? And so it's kind of in a way like a midlife movie, because these characters are old enough to have that time, you know, they've had time to live and they can reflect, but they're not, you know, at the end of their lives, they have life ahead of them. So they're also reflecting about the future. You know, there's a certain longing that we see with Sonny where he's, I imagine him kind of wondering in his mind, like, am I ever going to find love. Like, you know, after you've had like a bunch of bad dates or something, and you're just like, maybe there's just no one out there for me. And I could just imagine when he's looking out.
Called 2021 on Tinder for a girl who's a normal.
That's
person.
Called my current existence.
I didn't want to tar my co-host with a brush, but like two of my very good friends, Maria Lewis, who's my like one of my best mates, and Katie, the toil that they go through to find normal human beings, Justin, is just.
Oh my god!
I don't want any part of it.
We haven't even like talked about this, but I'm sure you can just sense the energy. Maria and I are so like simpatico.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Anyway, yes, but yes, I will say, big mood.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, it's like he's this guy. I mean, okay, so Colin Farrell I looked it up, he's 30 when this movie is made, but I sort of feel like he's supposed to be playing a little bit older.
He
certainly comes across older.
I mean, Colin Farrell's living is like dog years. You know what I mean? Like yeah, the yeah, amount yeah, of yeah. life he lived every year to 30.
Yeah, it's true.
Outland. He's 121 in this movie.
No, exactly. Yeah, but with 100 more years to go, he's the Clint Eastwood of of undercover cops. But you know, so I just, and then there's also this kind of like, so that's like future reflect. You know, they're like thinking about the future, and there's the past, like regret potentially, like did I make the right choice? And then there's this kind of like reflection, like at the like I don't know middle ground where you're reflecting on like your current situation, and here. What is he reflecting on? He's like, well, Rico and Trudy have this amazing relationship. I kind of imagine almost the sex scenes and stuff, the like the shower scenes and everything. It's like from, I mean, this is gonna sound weird, but like from Sonny's perspective, because it's almost like he's like imagining like what their relationship is like. And then he gets it with Isabella in, in Cuba. And so, and it's like, they're almost like the same. They have this very similar
kind of,
they both have that, like, there's like a parallelism there. So it's like, he's like playing out what he's wanted, but he can't have it. And that's, I find this like, that's, it's just a gut punch. It's so tragic. It's so, and it's tragic at like a level that like, you don't see in movies today. I mean, in a movie of this budget, just to like go all in on and they're not going to be together at the end because they can't, because that's what we've been telling you this whole time, is such a bold creative choice and such a real one, so one that reflects, you know, something that many of us have experienced. And I think it's like deeply profound. Ballsiness about it that it's like, it makes me long for movies like this. Those are some of the things that
it really is amazing. Like, I was thinking about this, I guess, this morning, and I was thinking about Mann and his adaptations and how this is a reboot of a TV show it's not really an adaptation, but he always is smuggling his themes and his auteurist outlook into James Fenimore Cooper, Thomas Harris, a biopic or a true, like The Insider. That's not true crime. That's like, I don't know, whatever you would call that. But
it's definitely a dramatization. And
we just don't
call it true crime because it's white collar.
But it's like a based on a true story corporate crime movie. You know, it's like all these, it's like not necessarily different genres, but it's like these different kinds of adaptations. And I mean, it is kind of amazing that Universal was like, they're expecting fucking Starsky and Hutch. What I mean? When they're like, let Michael Mann remake Miami Vice. They're like, great. Get some loud pants on Colin Farrell and sign some checks. And then they're like, it's like sad and tragic. And it's about like, the, you know, conflict between personal choice and like relentless entropy of the world and things moving forward. And it's like that tension between, can you choose this or can you not? Because you're already like off in this cycle or on this, you know, path, the two paths that diverge in the wood. But it's just really amazing that they like, that this happened. And every time we talk about this, it's like, it's a complete miracle that this movie was made.
I just love that, like,
The actual director of Starsky and Hutch is Todd Phillips from 2004. So it's only 2 years earlier that they remade Starsky and Hutch with Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson, as
the leads, right? So and then Snoop Dogg.
Yes.
Really?
So why that's so funny. Yeah, Snoop Dogg's in it. But I was just going to say, yeah, Snoop Dogg plays Huggy Bear Brown. Snoop, what I think is hilarious is that they're like, you can see them going, oh, yeah, it's going to be loud. It's going to be flamboyant. It might be a bit more like grounded in reality, but this is definitely the same energy.
But it's going to be like a Will Smith video or something.
And you just like, and you just wonder, at what point did the worm turn? Like, at what point did the worm turn and they go, oh, no, this is just another Michael Mann movie? Like, I mean, and for us, we're like, yes, another Michael Mann movie, you know? Oh, man, that's so, so funny.
I mean, my guess is it turned 2 minutes into the movie.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because, you know, you're sitting there and you're watching the numb encore scene and you're just like, I can't understand what the fuck is going on here. And, like... And then 10 minutes later, you realize that whatever sting operation they were involved in, we're never coming back to that.
Yes.
So all the mental energy you were devoting trying to figure out who's who in the it doesn't matter because we're never coming back. It's like we're moved on. That was a previous episode of My Heavy Vice. I just think like there's so many like anti-commercial moves that are being made here that I really love it. I love when movies just full on embrace that kind of like, you're going to come on board with me, not the other way around. I'm not going to cater to what you expect and what you want from me. You'll come to me. And then you know, oftentimes that can be alienating for people, but I think in this case, because it's directed by someone who has such a steady hand, who can bring you along, he bends you to his will. And I mean, Quentin Tarantino is another director like that who really loves, I mean, he's explicitly said this where he wants to play the audience like an orchestra, right? He wants to like know at each point in the movie what they're going to be feeling and then sort of exploit that. Mann is less cynical about it. Obviously he's trying to do this for his own expression, but I feel like these great directors often have that idea of like, it's like, I guess it's kind of like the Steve Jobs mentality. It's like, you don't know what you want. I will show you what you want.
Yeah.
I
know what you want. You don't have to know what you want. I'm going to tell you what you want.
Yeah.
That's so comforting when you're watching a movie made by like a great master and everything's clicking like that. I mean, that's just like the best feeling.
Yeah, and then you have to submit to the director. And that's the thing that I find so, so deeply compelling. And actually speaking of that's the scene with Alonzo, I think there's two bits of foreshadowing there that are really interesting. So one is it raises the stakes, you're totally right. So like it makes it, we see that someone who's effectively trying to play both sides, Alonzo, so he's like a drug dealer or whatever, and he's working with the cops and whatever. So you try to play both sides, you could lose out. And actually you see this both with him and killing his family and all that, but you also see it with the Aryan Brotherhood who take in, it's like cross cut with them, with the sniper that like takes out the guy in the car. So you immediately now know, okay, this is the danger of the world these guys live in. Like if you make one false move, you could just get completely, you could get blown up. But the other thing that I thought was kind of cool about this, and I only noticed it this time, is when they show the photo of John, I don't remember John Hawks' character's name, but when they show his-
Alonzo.
When Alonzo's wife, the photo of his wife who's been captured, you see around her neck, it's the same bomb device. It's the same thing that they put around Trudy. And it's so immediately foreshadowing that like, it's not just a danger to you, that you could be the one who gets killed, but like your loved ones. And that's what happens to Trudy. And so I think that like, it's brilliant filmmaking because it doesn't call attention to itself, and it's not something you would even catch the first time. But the second time you realize that's what he was doing. He was setting up all of the stakes and what's, you know, what could happen and the dangers of this world, and foreshadowing what is really, I mean, sadly going to come. So I thought that
right.
was just
like they brilliant. Become the Alonzo.
They become the Alonzo. But also, it's also a great trick too, because you go, oh, Alonzo's wife is just a mum she's just a normal person. It can't happen to our people, right? Like, there's that reinforcement of like, oh, Trudy's a badass. Like, we've got badasses in our team. They're going to be fine. They know their trade craft. They can look after each other. So when Trudy does get nabbed, you're like, oh no, they're just, it's like that further like fear element comes over the over you as you're a viewer. If you're invested, it's like, oh my God, even she's vulnerable to this. Yeah. And I think that that's the one superiority of the director's cut. Like,
yes. And then I was just going to say, like, if Sonny is watching, if he's the one who's sort of witnessing or imagining whatever you want to imagine of the Tubbs and Trudy relationship, then he's also learning, oh, wait, then if I'm in love with someone, then they can be vulnerable and they can be hurt and I can lose them. And like, it's not worth it. Or like, it's like, this is the risk, this is the danger. Maybe it is worth it, but he's watching that happen. And so it all ties into like, you know, part of why the choice isn't even, it's not even that they like make the choice. It's like the choice is made for them.
Right.
That's exactly what I wanted to, I'm so glad you said that, Kay, because like one of the big reasons I wanted to talk to Justin on this show is like when I was studying Michael Mann and being like, you know, my most academic critical writing and study, my supervisor at the time was a professor at the University of Newcastle in Australia, Hamish Ford, great film mind. It was like, he introduced me to a philosopher called Immanuel Kant, K-A-N-T, not the other word that you thought I might've been saying because of my Australian accent. He did a book called The Critique of Judgment, which is extremely dense theoretical stuff. So I don't imagine that anyone is necessarily going to read it, but I'll try and synthesize it and Justin will correct me because he's the expert.
I have it on the shelf here.
No, please. You don't have to get it. Here he goes. There it is.
Oh my gosh.
Take a power and judgment. Right. Yeah. So he got me into what it, like was this Immanuel Kant's concept of the sublime. And he basically saying that the sublime in his concept, and I'll definitely please jump in, Justin, if I'm saying it wrong, but the way that I understood it always and interpreted it was that the sublime is this lure, this thing that is so attractive. And often they talk about it like in the natural world of like the ocean, like the boundless ocean with no land around it has a sublime quality, or like volcanoes, because the power, the immensity, the unpredictability, it just dwarfs your humanity, right? And so that thing that happens in Miami Vice, this scene we've talked about so many times, which is, you know, Colin Farrell's Crockett staring out to the ocean and actually engaging with this sublime force that is a hurricane above an ocean. It was always, for me, it directly correlated with that exact thing of these guys are in this job and they're going to make decisions that they're compelled to make, like that take them to these situations that are going to dwarf them. They're going to potentially kill them because of the immense power of these sublime forces that are around them, but they cannot help it. That's the thing that Kant sort of describes, is that there's a lure, like, you know, it's dangerous. You're like a moth to a flame. You're like, oh, look, here's a volcano. It's so beautiful. Like, I think they joke about it in A Bug's Life, right? It's beautiful. And then the bug gets zapped by the bug zapper. But that's like, that moment is what I feel so much about Crockett. And so whenever I watch it, that's when we talk about the philosophy of Miami Vice. That sublime philosophy that is sort of undercutting and underpinning that motivation for me has always been extremely strong, because it is the difference between what is impulse and what is something that like you're maybe, I don't know, like unconsciously compelled to do. And we've had a couple of convos, and this is one Twitter convo, because I want to bring this up. There's a great moment in Heat, Katie, you'll know the moment, when John Voight calls Neil McCauley, John Voight's Nate calls Neil McCauley, and he says,
"It's me.
Plane's in the air now. We ran out of time. On the driver's end, I still can't find nobody, so that's in the trust. One other thing. You asked, so I gotta tell you. Guy you wanted checked into the Hotel Marquis under Jameson, if you still give a shit. Which I figured you wouldn't.
You figured right.
So long, brother. You take it easy. You're home free.
Take it easy.
What is it?
Nothing. I'm free.
And I talk about how goddamn tragic and irresponsible that is. He knows that Neil is not going to make the right choice and just escape on a plane that it is going to be a shadow exit out of LAX, go and live happily ever after with Edie. He knows he's going to take it to the edge. He knows he's going to go try and kill Wango and that's it. So when he says home free, it's that same thing of like, no, you've just given him the thing that is going to make him die. And it's so tragic. And I feel like that's happening in this movie in Miami Vice. It's that same thing of like, these guys are going to take it to the limit. Crockett does not, and Tubbs does not know, they don't know what it's like to live a normal life. They're always going to take it to the limit. They're always going to be like moths to the flame. And then sometimes they're going to flame out or the people around them are going to get hurt.
Yeah. I mean, on the sublime, so I'm not like a content expert. So I have the book here, but I'm not, you know, one of the things that you, when you study philosophy or whatever, and you study anything too long, you start to realize how much you don't actually know about it. And then you get really sheepish about saying anything about it because you don't want to be corrected by your colleagues who are actually Kant scholars or whatever.
So, you know more than us.
Oh, geez. Yeah. But I also want to recommend that my colleagues listen to this.
Oh.
But
none of Justin's colleagues leave any comments.
That's right.
You're going to get real mad.
Yeah. This is
unless it's positive. Unless it's a nice
unless
comment.
It's positive.
Positive hot takes.
And validating.
But here's another way of thinking about the sublime. So in Kant, there's the notion of the sublime, as I understand it, is like what you're saying, is this kind of overwhelming feeling of up. But it's also this kind of idea of like, and Kant is a big theme in Kant of like being sort of having a kind of dominion over nature. So we have free will, and that's like a central starting point for Kant. And thus we have sort of dominion where nature doesn't, because nature is subject to causal forces. And so, and the sublime is in some sense supposed to be some appreciation of like our separateness from nature at the same time as we're like part of it. But you kind of see that. I mean, that's a theme that gets picked up in the existentialists, you know, like Sartre and Kierkegaard and so on. And these guys, but they sort of, this focus on absolute freedom kind of is a two-sided coin for them. Because on the one hand, it's like, amazing. You're like, great. I could just like, if I'm Crockett, I can run away with Isabella. It doesn't matter that I've chosen a life of prosecuting.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Crime, and she's chosen a life of crime. We can just completely change our lives tomorrow. That's the ultimate freedom that we have. But the flip side of that coin, shout out to Heat, flip side of that coin is that the freedom comes with a kind of overwhelming anxiety, right? It's the thing that some have translated as angst or whatever. Yeah. And it's this thought that like Sartre called it like, he described it as like when you stare into the void and you realize that like you could literally do anything. You're not restricted in any way whatsoever. You could make any choice you want at any point. And one of the like, one of the questions that animated some of the existentialists thinking about this, in particular Albert Camus, is like, well, why don't I just kill myself then? Like, what stops me from killing myself?
Yeah.
And you can't be like, well, I want to go on living, because you're like, well, you could just decide not to want to go on living. Like, you have total freedom. So you have to find some way to like commit to something, but because there's no thing that you can fall back on to be like, that's the reason why I won't do this thing. It's sort of the act of committing is what anchors you or tethers you to reality or whatever, to creating yourself ultimately. And so
the act of podcasting keeps me tethered to this life.
Get in front of a mic and then Blake is good. Blake just needs a mic in his face and he's ready to go.
That's all I'm good. That's it.
But yeah, so I think you sort of see that. I mean, Mann has talked about in interviews about the existentialists, and I think there was one interview I saw with him where, what movie was it? It might have been Thief, where I think the interviewer was like, this seems sort of, I don't want to get this wrong, but anyway, he kind of threw it back at them. They were like, I think this is like existentialism. And he's like, no, you got it all wrong. This is actually like this other thing. I can't remember the details of what he said, but it was fascinating that he was versed in the existentialists and he knew how that interpretation on his film might go, and he rejected it and he had a different interpretation. So, you know, he really did have, I mean, there's a kind of, man has read philosophy. I'm 100% certain of this. And
yeah.
And you know, I don't think his films are explicitly philosophical, but I think that comes through in the fabric of the film. And I mean, all this stuff about regret and choice is deeply, it is very existentialist in the sense that it would be the kind of thing that the, like Sartre or the people, you know, who wrote existentialist literature in the 40s and 50s and 60s, like they would have loved, I mean, this would have just fit right in with what they were writing.
You could tell that it's like he's making these from like a more human and dramatic level, but you can totally see if you use it as a case study or an example, it fits all the boxes, but he's like, I'm not making an existentialist text like that prescribes to these conventions. I'm making, like, I think you pointed out, I'm making Romeo and Juliet. Like, I'm making a Romeo and Juliet story, but it's in the context of South American drug cartels. Like, and it just happens to have all of that existential angst that happens in these movies. And that, I think that engagement with existentialism is exactly why he's still a new Hollywood filmmaker who's making movies in 2006, right? Like, that's why when you look at, even Malick, let's just say like Malick and those guys and De Palma and Scorsese and Coppola, like that, some of their films are more explicitly taken because that's the time, the Vietnam War time and the Watergate time, that like America is having their own existential crisis. But whereas Mann is like making TV and doing other things, it's then when he actually gets an opportunity to tackle these texts himself in cinema, like he's still got that philosophy of everyone being engaged at that time. You know, I think that's what comes through most strongly for me.
I think when I read philosophy, I admittedly haven't read a ton of philosophy, just like some stuff in film theory classes, but just even listening to you talk about it, it's like, oh, like the thing that philosophy reminds me is like being a human is hard. Yeah. And like, even though in our day-to-day lives, like we realize that, but it's like, but why? Why is it hard? Why is it hard to be a human being?
Yeah.
But philosophy sort of says like, it's challenging. Like you have to make decisions and you have to be with other people and you have to like just exist in time. And I think like Michael Mann movies like also do that. Like they're like, it's angsty. It's hard. It's challenging. Like the shit ain't for the faint hearted, just existing in the world.
And you're also going to contend where people might see a snapshot of a photo of the three of us like in this, but Justin's background is, as opposed to watching the whole video, but Justin's background is from Thief, and like also contending with people whose philosophies about what life is are so different to you. Like the Thief speech from James Cameron as Frank, where he's like,
Look, in what I do, there are some times pressures. What the hell do you think that I do? Come on, come on. Come on, every morning I walk in for 5 months, say hi. What the hell do you think that I do?
You sell little fucking cars, that's what you do.
I wear $150 slacks. I wear silk shirts. I wear $800 suits. I wear a gold watch. I wear a perfect D, flawless, 3-carat ring. I change cars like other guys change their fucking shoes. I'm a thief. I've been in prison, all right?
So what? I don't care.
So what?
Don't tell me.
So what? I never even told my wife that.
I don't
Who
care.
Who is now gone? Did I ever come on to you?
No.
What'd you see?
See what?
See, I am a straight arrow. I am a true blue kind of a guy. I've been cool. I am now unmarried. So let's cut the mini moves and the bullshit and get on with this big romance.
What?
It's like, wow, that person is living way less a life of artifice than some of us. Like, there's no cordiality. There's none of this stuff that we have to, like, adhere to, like, prescribe to, like, here are the rules or what would be nice if we're going to be polite to one another in, you know, life. It's like, I'm a man, you're a woman. I'm attracted to you. I'm a thief. Let's go. Like, that's, yep. And I love, like, those, sometimes it's really explicit, but it's like, he just likes to throw these people who live these different existences and have these completely right. different life philosophies sometimes right at each other. Like, let's just throw yeah. them straight at each other and see what kind of chemistry I can create with these characters.
Or yes. like two people who are so different, but like find their similarities. Like,
yeah.
like Heat kind of.
Oh, absolutely. That's well, the, sure. that's just a collision course of two people who've almost taken the exact same philosophy and just done it from each right. side of the coin, yeah. right? Like, they're literally flip sides of the coin. We've just taken that same level of choice, commitment, dedication, you know, like myopia about a philosophy, a working philosophy. And then we're just going to put them on the same train track and then just see who survives the collision at the end of this.
right.
And that, and that's the movie makes it literal with the trains, you know, like,
yes.
it's trains and planes and travel. And like, we're going to just smash these things together and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys brought up Thief and Heat because so these are all like crime movies, but like it is interesting how different Sonny and in some sense Rico are from Frank and in Thief and Pacino yeah. and De Niro and Heat yeah. Because those characters, by contrast, there's not really much of a they don't question their lives. They're just like, yeah, as yeah. you said, they're just like, I'm a thief. Like, this is what I do. Let's get on with the big romance. And like, in Heat, just like, let's.
The
let's
greatest pickup line of all time.
like, yeah, I thought the greatest pickup line was like, I'm into metals.
Yeah.
What's your problem, lady? I like metals.
lady, what but, do you know, care about who I am or what I do?
Yeah. but you know, so, but those characters, there's no question. They don't know. They do not question their. Who they are in life and what they, you know, want to, you know, what they want from life and who they, and the kind of person they are and that kind of thing. And these characters, by contrast, are, they're like really, really pensive and concerned that maybe they've made the wrong choice and they want to change their lives and they're sort of facing this uncertain future and they're not, you know, move to just continue the lives that they've lived before. And I think that's really a nice contrast. I mean, Frank and Thief is such an extreme contrast because he's a guy who, like, when it turns out that, like, he might, his life and Tuesday Weld's life might be in jeopardy, he literally, like, sends her away, burns down their house and then kills that guy and then just runs off into the distance. Like, he doesn't give a shit. Like, he just throws everything away. He has exactly what Sonny wants and he just throws it all away. He doesn't care.
Yeah. And I also think that one person we haven't talked enough about at the moment is Rico, because you said in that yeah. shower scene. So in that shower scene, Sonny and Isabella are together and they're constantly in the embrace, and Sonny kind of, while he's embracing her, kind of ruins it with the, or makes it a problematic scene because he then starts to like negotiate business while they're in this really private and beautiful intimate moment. That's the way that he kind of jeopardizes that relationship, because he starts realizing like, oh shit, I'm actually playing a role here as well as this is really satisfying me. But even with Rico and Trudy, he's like, he wants to have these intimate moments and she wants the intimacy, but he wants to get out of the shower. Like, it's almost like he doesn't quite want to accept, or at least outwardly accept, that he needs her as much as he does, or he values the relationship. He's still keeping her at an arm's length. And so it's like, I love what you said earlier, Justin. I've been thinking about it the whole time since you said it, of like, he's keeping her at an arm's length. He's pushing her back just a little bit. He's getting out of the shower early. He's pretending he's asleep. You know, he's doing those things and trying to keep it cordial, and keep the job right front of mind, just like Crockett is doing in a different way. But at the end of the day, he has to surrender to the fact that he at least has this connection and he does love her. But they're both doing that. They're both playing that. How do I put the job between me and my great love?
Right. Yeah. And that, of course, is a classic man theme. Of course. Yeah. And, I mean, you know, finding that, you know, that work-life balance. Basically, they should just show Michael Mann movies at, like, the work-life balance seminars. We always have these at MIT. They're like, oh, do you want to come learn how to, like, balance your extreme responsibilities
I beg you, Justin. It's like, guys, I'm going to take the work-life balance seminar this week. Oh, yeah, Justin, what are you planning? We're doing a double feature of Thief and Miami Vice. And that's what we're doing. That's the work-life balance. And people can go away and, like, write us a, you know, an extended response. Let's just say only like 500-600 words on their appreciation or understanding of work-life balance based on the characters Frank and Sonny Crockett. And they can also pair that with like a nice little mural they can create about work-life balance, and then we're good. Like, that's a great little task. So that's a gift from me to you. And so, yeah.
Noted. Like, noted. We're doing that at the next one.
I think you have to do that. Yeah, you're so right.
But no, it is funny to be like, okay, Michael Mann films are about work-life balance.
Yeah, I mean, that's
they are.
Yeah, I don't know. that's my pitch to people for Michael Mann films. But yeah, on the like get through this week. So that's another, you know, classic philosophical tract, The Myth of Sisyphus. And if you go to MIT's website, it used to be the case. I don't think they have it anymore. They had a little GIF of the guy rolling the rock, Sisyphus rolling the rock. Yeah. But actually, I think actually we had masks made recently, and they have that guy rolling the rock on them.
Oh, that's so good.
Which is nice, but also like, it's a little weird to give your graduate students like the Sisyphus myth on their, so they can like look at it all the time when they're talking to each other. Like,
yeah,
it's a little bit of a weird reminder that just like we're in this rat race forever.
But it's also kind of like, I like that it's honest. It's like,
that's right. Well,
you're just going to just be pushing shit uphill for the rest of your life, guys. So just get used to it. This is what it is.
Right.
Oh, actually, that brings me to the end of the film, actually, because I actually thought like, you know, the ending I think is super tragic, but at the same time, there's something. So that final shot, you guys know all too well. And I actually hadn't clocked it as the final. I mean, I've seen this movie only like maybe 5 times. So I've just, this time I was like paying really close attention to what is the final shot. The final shot is Sonny walking into the hospital. He's so silhouetted. But like the way he's walking into the hospital, I find really fascinating. So he's just basically learned he cannot be with the woman he loves. And he also knows that like his partner's girlfriend or whatever, who is also his you know, co-worker might die. But he walks with purpose. He is like striding in there. He's not like head down, dejected. This is terrible. My life sucks. Everything's bad. He's sort of accepted his fate, I feel. He goes in there with like head held high. He's ready to go. He's ready to be with his friends and support his partner. I think there's a sort of like exemplariness. I don't even know if that's a word, but there's something exemplary about that. Although he's a really tragic dude, obviously he's got his flaws and his vices. He has this sort of, I don't know, it's really redeeming that he can maintain that level of positivity in spite of everything that he's gone through in this film and what he's looking down the barrel at, which is like, I imagine him to be coming up on 40. He's got no significant other. He's almost thrown his entire life away but he's kind of pulled himself back. You know, he basically just went through a midlife crisis, and he still walks in there with purpose. And I find that that's like a lesson for all of us, right? Even as we you know, get beat down day to day and we're like, just got to get through this week, you know, Sonny's been really beat down. I can hold my head up high like Sonny. Yeah.
Man do job good. That's man, what I always say. Yeah, man like, do job good.
but also I think it's the I'll never doubt you of it all. Like that's the that's one of the best. It's like Rico has been a pillar, like so strong for him in the chaos that is Sonny. And so it's almost like it would feel disingenuous to their friendship and like not match how connected they are together if he didn't strut back in there with purpose to like be right next to his boy, no matter what happens, because his guy, like Rico gives him the nod to go with her to do what he's got to do. And I feel like this movie's weird, beautiful ebbs and flows and balances is just that moment of like, we don't need, we've seen that Trudy's maybe regaining consciousness, which is amazing as the movie, you know, and he's just going in and he's got to be there for Rico and Trudy. And it, regardless of what happens next, that's how he's got to do it. So yeah, I love that final shot. I love clocking those things where you, because, you know, from a guy who I credit with the greatest final shot of all time.
Is it this one?
No, it's not this one. No, this is not the greatest. It's Heat. It's
yeah. No,
it's,
no, no. I mean, this is what I mean. I'm doing
the
Heat.
Sorry,
shot.
The hair. Yeah,
sorry.
That's the greatest shot of all time. That's it's indisputable on any podcast I produce. I will just even if I get a valid argument, I'll cut it out of the show. That's my I'm mad with power, right? As the editor, but this shot kind of it slips. It just slips past you. Yeah. I love that you call attention. I love the moments that we haven't called attention to yet, Katie.
So
fun of this show right now is there's some moments that have slipped past us. And I think today we've been able to grab
I know. I'm so glad we're touching down on this. And I'm also thinking about how thoughtfully filmmakers want to leave you feeling at the end. Like, I think that's something that they really sort of labor over is like, how do you want to feel? And so, you know, we've been talking a lot about how this movie is a tragedy and it's a doomed romance and all of these things, but he's not leaving us with Sonny staring out the window or looking sad or dejected or whatever, or even walking in a, you know, Charlie Brown way. like, or like, you know, Michael Bluth or George Michael Bluth. Like, but you know, he wants to leave us feeling like there's still action, there's still motion, there's still purpose. Yep. There's still purpose that Sonny can fill as a friend and as a partner and that he has something to do, you know, like or a mission, even if it's just standing at the foot of the bed or whatever it might be. So, I love that he leaves us with that feeling of forward momentum rather than being stuck or not knowing what to do. Like he knows what to do in this moment in time. And the thing to do is to walk back in and to be there.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this film, the stakes in this film are, I mean, obviously it's life and death, but it's in a way, so they're so deeply personal. So the Sonny and Isabella's love basically jeopardizes everyone around them. Because, you know, so when sort of he comes back from Cuba, when Sonny comes back from Cuba, he's basically telling the FBI guy, Fujita or whatever, he's saying, hey, we got to go deep. We got to keep on these guys and we're going to go all the way. And Fujita's like, I'm getting out of here. But he gets basically he gets Rico and he gets Castillo to support him in that. And they're just staking their reputation and their careers and whatever on Sonny. Whereas
the greatest Barry Shabaki Henley line of all time is looks back and goes, you motherfuckers better be right.
Yeah. It's great. No, it's great. But it really shows you like these guys have put it out there for Sonny. They've put themselves out there for Sonny. And in that moment, if you're watching this for the first time, I mean, we know how it's going to go down. But if you're watching the first time, you don't know.
Yeah,
where he is. And I mean, Rico doesn't even know where he is in that moment. He asks him, like, do you know which way is up? Right. Like, or whatever. He asks him that basically he wants to know, like, are you ready for that? You know, you've gone too deep or whatever. And but he sort of supports him unquestioningly. And, you know, that is virtuous friendship right there. You know, that's like, I disagree with you potentially because I don't even know what's going on in your head, but I'm going to agree with you anyway. I'm gonna.
Yeah, I'll back you, but I just need to ask the question.
Yeah,
I think it's like a much more crude. Obviously, it's much more poetically sort of devised and then, you know, articulated between both of them in the performances and in the script. But like, that's just like, I have to ask, but I'll never doubt you. Like,
right.
if you say no, you're good, I won't doubt you. I need to ask you the question. And I think that's a special moment. And like that whole wind up is just so beautiful. It's like, you're making moves on Montoya's woman. We're making moves on each other. It's the coolest line that deflects a massive problem. It's like you're hooking up with exactly. I think, Justin, you're the first person to say it like this. I think it's great. The number two in the Montoya crime family, because she is literally the number two. And you're like, God, this whole international conspiracy. She's number two, and he's shagging her in Cuba. Like, this is a problem.
I mean, she also similarly stakes everything on Sonny because Montoya is like, you know, Euro doesn't like this guy, you know, and she proposes the thing that Sonny proposed to her, that they partner up and everything. And she says, well, you know, she gives her argument, which is kind of feeble, but like, she clearly wants to do this. And so everything, I just love how all of those stakes are set up. So it's so, you know, it's like he's built this house of cards and we all know it's going to fall because this just can't be. Yeah. But if the question is, how is it going to fall? Who's going to be left standing next to whom at the end of this? And it's great that even though Sonny and Isabella can't be together, that Sonny is still standing next to Rico, because there's a real possibility, like Sonny in another scene right after this is basically floating the idea to Isabella that they just run off together. Right. He's just like, you should just cash out. And
you should cash out and I'll find you. I can't jump out just yet and I'll find you.
But like, if he does that, he would be, you know, he'd be letting his partner down, right? He'd be quitting and moving on and doing whatever. So I think it's great that there's that real tension of like, which way are they going to go? And in particular, which way is Sonny going to go? You know, can he do this thing? Can he take this leap? And it just, the stakes are so high. And I feel like, for me, that's what brings me back to the movie, is that I'm like, at every point I can almost watch it for the first time thinking about this, because I can just put myself back in the perspective of like, I don't know what he's going to do. Because I think actually in those moments, the way I read the character is that he doesn't know what he's going to do. Like, he doesn't really know. When he proposes that to her, I don't know, Blake, you might have a different take on this, I think, from what you said earlier, but I kind of feel like when he makes that proposal in Cuba, he's not sure whether he's like, maybe we can just get out and maybe we can just run away together. Or if he's like, I'm sort of drawing her in on the reel.
One episode before this, and Katie and I are both in smiling, I think, cause we know this is like, we spoke to a really great, great guest, Thomas Grabinski, who has a great show, Movies at the Bar, and a great podcast. And we were all marveling at the fact that not only is the character unpredictable, but the fact that Colin Farrell is completely blackout.
I see.
Blackout, whatever, on whatever substances you want to call it, like blacked out for the duration of that movie, that I actually do not recognize him as Colin Farrell in this movie. He is Sonny Crockett so utterly and completely, and is so gone that you're like, there's no more Colin there. Like, it's like that stupid Joaquin Phoenix pseudo documentary. Like, I'm still here. Like, it's like, he's gone. He's not there anymore. And so, yeah, I think that unpredictability is just like, it's fed by the fact that this guy who's delivering the lines is literally unpredictable in that moment.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm like, I don't think he's like minute to minute. He's like an ant, kind of like, I think he's just like, what's in front of me? I'm making that decision. Like, I don't know that he like ever knows what he's going to do except what's in front of him at that moment, which is kind of like a great way to live, I guess. Like, just like so hyper present.
Yeah.
Like, want to get a mojito in Cuba? Yes, I do. Like, oh shit, I gotta go back. Okay. Like, you know, he's just moment by moment, he's so present that he's not thinking about the consequences of things necessarily. Or maybe not thinking about the consequences, but thinking about what comes next and what comes next.
Yeah, I think you're right. In that moment, he's sort of just chosen not to worry about it. I mean, he knows in some sense what will happen. But like, you're right that I think in that moment, he's just kind of blocked it. Like we all do this. We don't think about.
I want to give you guys another theory. You hear about these films that occasionally do what is ultimately a crazy decision. And usually a luxury, if you've got lots of money or you have a powerhouse director and actor, is sometimes you shoot a film chronologically.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is so rare. Like in acting, obviously on a stage, you're practicing chronologically so you can help evolve the performance and just know how each scene influences the mood of the next scene and those things. But in cinema, it's just like, chop it up. What's the most convenient? What location do we have, etc. And I think that's so hard. Filmmakers try and get into their actors' heads. All right, in this scene, remember it comes after the scene we shot 3 weeks ago. And so much. And everyone else around them in this movie, everyone else around Colin Farrell is doing that. Where is my motivation right now because of the previous scene?
Yeah,
you know the one person who's not doing it at any point in this movie? Colin Farrell. He's not. He's just not there. It's Sonny in the moment. Exactly. Like the most hyper-present performance because it's like, all I can think of is what is in front of my face.
Yes.
Right now. Do you guys have a favorite, just we're on the Sonny kick. So do you guys have a favorite Sonny line?
Oh. I mean, we have the ones that we like say all the time.
Yeah.
Which are like his horrible pickup lines.
The pickup lines. Yeah. Yeah. So here, I'll give you one. Well, if you're thinking about it.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines of his is a one word line. It's so, okay, here's the scene. So it's when they meet Yiro for the first time.
Yeah.
And Yiro's like, how do you know? I guess it's two words, but how do you know that you guys can do this? He's like questioning them. He's like,
yeah,
who are you? How do I? And then Sonny, price, what's right? That?
Price is right. But how I know if you any good at this shit?
What's that?
What's that? Like, he's so indignant. He's so pissed off that he's like, you question my skill? What's that?
That scene where the three of them meet for the first time is maybe my favorite scene in the movie.
Amazing.
There's so many great lines. And
my mommy and daddy know me. Let's get that line too.
That's just what he
another,
got. Right
just another banger.
Jamie Foxx just has some real bangers in that line too. I think anytime Colin Farrell's talking about Lowe's.
You with the thieves.
Yes, the theme. I was like, what does he call the FBI? I'm like,
you spotted that for me. I like went back and watched it after that episode. I was like, fucking Katie smashed that out of the park. That was awesome. It's like,
oh my God. No, there's so many good lines in that scene. I just love it so
and
much.
Also,
and obviously, we love our very special John Ortiz killing it as always.
John Ortiz absolutely killing it.
Gochi Loco.
Like the great one after that is like, so you want to fuck my partner? Like, I just like that everyone is completely feeling themselves in that scene. Like they are just, everyone is just chef's kiss.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
Oh my God.
The other part that I just noticed this time. So they've, of course, there's the Jackson Pollock line about the wallpaper.
Yeah.
And I noticed it this time. Maybe you guys have already noticed this, but so that's actually a foreshadow. Because he gets Jackson Pollocked at the end.
He does.
So Rico shoots him with the shotgun and the blood splatter goes on the whatever shipping container and it's like a Jackson Pollock. It's like a splatter painting. So he does get him in that very way.
Nice, nice spot.
Yeah, it is good because but that whole description of him being a Jackson Pollock is so great too. Cause you're like, oh, is this just BS? But the fact that he does turn him into that and he does splatter all over the place is beautiful. Yeah. It's great. Bit of poetry.
Wonderful.
Good pickup. And we haven't talked about it. So that's good. I'm glad you brought it up. Oh my God. Justin, this has been so much fun. I feel like we're about to go down a rabbit hole and just start repeating lines like, you know the Allman Brothers, like, which is what we eventually do when it's time to wrap on this show. But look, thank you so much for being a part of Miami Nice with us. It's been really fun. And like, I feel like we were diligent philosophy students at some point along the way. So thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Yes,
it's been great to chat to you.
I feel smarter. Thank you for this. It was super fun.
Thank you for having me. I it was a blast. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.